The description of this talk on the website said, do we see ourselves or do we just react with aversion and craving? And I thought, I know all about the six realms or these six psychological planes, the hell realm, the god realm, but do I really use this wheel? Do I really use the Tibetan wheel of life to see myself and allow it to provide insights into my own practice? And when I read the introduction out to my husband, he just laughed, because I really work with the wheel, but by no means have I got the hang of it, or do I really face the true nature of myself on a regular basis? So I know there are parts of myself that I don't like, that I'm afraid of, and that I'm even ashamed of, and that's the point, isn't it, really? That's why we're here. So each of us will know these six realms all in our own way. But this is my way, and by no means is it the only way. So I'm just inviting you to hold an open heart and open your eyes up and look into this mirror, this wheel of life. So before I go into describing the six realms or the worlds of the wheel of life, I just want to talk a bit about symbols. So when the Buddha gained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, he saw a vision of human existence. And in a sense, that was identical with his experience of enlightenment. And he communicated this in four ways. He communicated it through concepts, through symbols, through actions, and through silence. So symbols are an integral part of understanding the Dharma. The wheel itself is symbolic. So it's a symbol of the Buddhist perspective, of the human situation. So all that Dharma in just that image. And I think it's amazing, really. I think symbols are fascinating, in that they're different to signs. So signs can be described in different ways, like an arrow. An arrow is a shortcut image to a point in a particular direction. But symbols are special because symbols cannot be known or understood in any other way. And I just want to say that again, to be really clear, that symbols cannot be known or understood in any other way. So therefore, if the wheel and all the elements of the wheel are symbolic, then it can only be known through these symbols, which then makes writing a talk about it a little bit tricky. So there are three types of symbols. There's the colour form, which are images, such as the wheel. There's the sound form, which are mantras, for example, and then the acted out form, which are the behaviours, such as rituals or devotional practices. And so all of these things have a way of connecting with us beyond words, beyond the mundane, to things that we often just didn't know about ourselves. And that's important because what I'm wanting to do tonight is to use the wheel as a mirror, a way of accessing how we really see ourselves, how we see these worlds or these mind states, and where we dwell most often, and how knowing ourselves, I mean really knowing ourselves, will help us to live a spiritual life. So I've realised that practicing the Dharma isn't about learning academic theory. It has a lot of value, but it's really about learning and developing through our own experience and reflections. So I'd like to explore how I see the wheel and hope that by using the wheel in this way, it takes us away from seeing it as a symbol of, or kind of a depressing symbol of human existence, but perhaps allows us to really see ourselves and the potential for change. So now we're just talking a little bit more about those circles. And Bhante talks about what it would be like if we use the wheel as a mirror, as like a mirror of truth, so to speak, in which we could really see ourselves. Not just a concept of ourselves or a representation of ourselves, but truly see the real nature of ourselves. So when we look at the wheel and at the first circle or that first mirror, we see the pig, the snake and the cockerel. So when we, And perhaps we should ask, it's not who we see, but what do we see when we really look into this mirror? So I decided to look. And when I looked, I had this really strong direct experience of seeing a snake. And not just a representation or a concept of a snake, but a real snake. I was a green snake and I had white eyes. And that's quite unusual because usually the snakes have red eyes, but I don't suppose it really matters today. So I actually used to be really terrified of snakes. And I was so averse that if they came on TV, like in a nature program, I couldn't even bear to look at them. Although this has softened through the years, but I realized that when I saw the snake, I saw that hatred and that aversion and that anger. And I realized that I'm not so human and I'm not so civilized after all. But I want you to remember that this isn't a bad thing. This isn't something that I want to feel guilty about or be punished about or be instructed to be kinder. This is liberating because it's truthful. It's truthful and I can know how to work with it and I can know how to be less afraid. I can even befriend this snake. So you might think that there's this strange lady sitting here who sees a snake or thinks that she's one, and it all sounds a little bit crazy, but just bear with me. I hope that by the end of the talk it makes a little bit more sense and it gets clearer. So what is the point of really seeing ourselves and our true nature? Well, if we really get to know ourselves, then we can actually really accept ourselves. If we know where we are on the wheel and which worlds we dwell in, which of these psychological planes that we dwell in, then we can see what parts of us we might be ashamed of, what parts we're frightened of, and what parts we dislike. And we can see this realization wholeheartedly, and we can accept it. And that's the beginning of spiritual life. So just to be clear, traditionally the realms are seen as actual worlds, places that we can inhabit. However, we can also interpret them as these mind styles or mind states or psychological planes. And remember that this is exciting because in some way it does put our fate in our own hands. So the first realm at the top is the realm of the devas or the gods. And it's usually at the top and it's inhabited as described by gods. There's no evil in this realm. The inhabitants only have to think about something they desire and it arrives. So when I look in the mirror, it's a happy, pleased state of mind. Everything seems to go smoothly in this state. Everything seems to be in a flow. There are no difficulties. There are no obstacles. This state doesn't happen very often for me, but I recognize it in meditation. Usually when I'm on retreat or meditating for long periods of time at home. It feels as if everything in life just works. It feels as if things are easy. And I'm not able just to make things... I'm able to just let things come and go as they are. My heart is open, my mind is open. But we've got to remember that this doesn't last. This state doesn't last. Because it's still part of the mundane existence. It's still based on conditionality. It still isn't enlightenment, however lovely it might be at the time. So this stage is so filled with happiness that when eventually loss or suffering arrive, as they inevitably do, then there's a long way to fall. There's no resilience to the everyday harshness of life. The smallest of the difficulties are really felt painfully. Like when you return from retreat, even if it's a day retreat, and you're faced with two small toddlers, or you're faced with work, your flatmates, or just Auckland traffic. That integration is tough. It's bumpy. It doesn't go smoothly. So now each realm has a Buddha within it, a representation of Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of compassion, or the Bodhisattva of compassion, who broke into 11 heads and 1,000 arms to attend to the great sufferings of the world. So in this realm, there is a white Buddha who plays the Luna, or the Veena, or the lute. and she plays the melody of impermanence. There's nothing harsh or distasteful about this melody, because it just wouldn't work if there was. It's a beautiful melody that can touch the hearts of gods. And I think this realm sounds pretty amazing. Actually, I think I love it. I want to be happy all the time. I get my wishes and my wants fulfilled. I think it's awesome. So why don't I just meditate to create this mind state and have it every day? But the problem with being happy all the time, and yes, there is a problem with being happy all the time, is that there's no drive for things to be different. There's no suffering to abolish. And so the likelihood to become enlightened, so to move beyond this mundane conditioned existence, is very small. It's minute, in fact. And although it's lovely to be there, it's still part of this mundane world. And it doesn't last. It's not true nirvana. So if I look into the mirror and I'm in the realm of the gods, or I'm about to fall out of it, I want to cultivate patience and tenderness and kindness. And I find that by doing the Metta Bhavana practice, that it really supports this. And it doesn't have to be a 40-minute structured practice every day. I mean, I think that helps. But for me, it just has to be consistent and it has to be daily. And I use a lot of images when I'm in this state. So images of hands held together, of hearts, of nature, but also poetry. And I have them plastered all over the house, on the fridge. And it's just to remind me that when I'm in this state, that kindness is all that matters. So when we move now on to the second realm, and this is the realm of the Titans or the Asuras. And this is an aggressive, competitive state of mind, and it's filled with this fierce envy and hatred and jealousy. So it's deeply competitive, it's driven, and they're always looking down on others, and there's no patience in this realm. And in between this realm and the realm of the gods is the wish-fulfilling tree. And the Titans are continually waging war on the gods in a fight to gain possession of the fruits from this tree. So politics and high-powered business is often twinned with this mind state. However, I think it would be naive of us to think that we don't feel this, even though many of us are not in cutthroat business or politics. So this realm cultivates that desire to dominate others. You know, that desire to control or exercise power over others. So when I look into the mirror, I often feel this mind style when I experience a really strong sense of injustice. But the injustice, this anger, is actually not about the injustice itself. It's actually about the sense of being righteous. And I know that it's not a true sense of injustice, because the anger that I'm feeling is not in proportion to the injustice that's happened. And so an example of this is that I call it the casserole story, and this is cathartic, because the more I tell it, I think the more that I learn from it. So I made a vegetable casserole, and my husband had cooked some steak, and so for a number of reasons that we still eat some meat in our family. And my husband had gone for a barbecue at his dad's house and had come home with some cooked steak. And he had decided that he thought, yum, I'll make a beef casserole. And so he cut up the steak and he put it into the casserole pot. And it wasn't necessarily so much about the meat, because that still happens in our house sometimes. It was more about the fact that I had wanted a vegetable casserole and that I had cooked it the way that I wanted it. And I had felt like he had totally desecrated it. And there was an injustice. And yeah, I'm using the word injustice about a casserole. But it was because the hatred that I felt was totally overwhelming. And the anger that I felt about not being able to eat my casserole was totally out of proportion to the actual event. So because I wasn't harmed, but the rage I felt was just unwarranted. And it wasn't really until I reflected on this and I told someone, and they started laughing, and they said, you've used the word injustice in connection with a casserole. And I realized then that actually the intensity of the emotion really wasn't valid. And it was really more close to righteousness than actually than anything else. So be careful, because just because you aren't a titan, or that you don't work in cutthroat business, or if you even do, it doesn't mean that you won't feel these emotions. It's that polarization when I think that I'm right and others are wrong. It's very subtle, and it's quite sneaky, and it can come up on us. I think another example is that's really subtle is when we ask people how many years they've been coming to the Auckland Buddhist Centre. And we often do this as a way of getting to know people and connecting with them, sometimes when we first meet them or on retreat. But it almost has this sense of becoming a little bit competitive. So, oh, she's only been here a year. Oh, but I've been here 3 years or 5 years or 15 years. I mean, what does it really matter? But it's easy in the world of the titans to get tripped up and to fall into that, you know, that tightness and that competitiveness. So there's a green Buddha in this realm with a flaming sword of transcendental wisdom. And the sword, this sword develops an intellectual insight into truth and reality. So there is a strong connection between wisdom and hatred. Because if you really hate things, you just want to smash and destroy them. And so if you use hatred to smash and destroy delusion, then it can take you quite far in your practice. The only problem is that this hatred isn't sustainable and that it has limitations. But it is a strong energy. So I often can't think my way out of this mindset. So when I was standing in the kitchen raging over this casserole, I knew that it was, I did know deep down that it wasn't justified. But I found that even though I was thinking that, I was stuck. So I often use mantras, in particular the Avalokiteshvara mantra or the Shakyamuni Buddha mantra. Or I just let whatever comes to mind, because they allow me to connect with something that goes beyond words, and to be able to connect with that sense of wisdom that can let go of or smash through that sense of hatred. And if you don't know any mantras, then it's really easy just to Google them and to find one that you just like the sound of, that connects with you, because it's not actually about something academic or intellectual that you're trying to cultivate. So the next realm is the realm of the hungry ghosts, or the pritas. And this is a state of neurotic desire. So the inhabitants suffer by not being able to consume anything in this realm. So they've got swollen bellies and tiny mouths and tiny throats. And if they do manage to find something and to put it into their mouth, then it usually turns to fire or excrement. So this is the realm of obsession and addiction and compulsion. But this isn't just a state for those who suffer with addictions. When I look in the mirror, I remember experiences of relationships, of either when they ended or when they started. And that sense of when you just can't bear to be without a particular person. You know, we need them to be around. We need to be accepted by them. And often we can act quite desperate. We can act against our values just to get that, just to get that experience or time with them. So I can connect easily with this realm and that suffering experienced. And when I fall into some of the milder addictive behaviours that I have, just like, you know, eating when I feel bored or unhappy, or watching rubbish TV. For me, it's not so much that first behaviour that's the problem, it's more the suffering that comes after it, with the thoughts like, oh God, you're stupid, you should have done something different, or you should have done it better, or what's wrong with you? Why didn't you go and meditate? And I think we've got to remember that that's not kind and it's not accurate, and it doesn't actually help the situation. And it usually makes it worse. In fact, it actually doesn't get me what I need at all. It makes things worse. So what I actually need... So when I'm in that state, I actually need something else from what I'm looking for usually. I don't need to eat another piece of chocolate. You know, I don't need to watch more rubbish TV. Usually it's something emotional that I need, such as comfort, love, kindness, or forgiveness. So the Buddha in this realm is red and provides inhabitants with sustenance that they can actually consume. It's not actually real food as such, but it's the ability to see and be in the present. It's an ability or a gift of awareness to be able to see what they really need or what we really need. So it's not the food or the drugs or the romantic person that we think we might want, but it's actually that emotional sense of what we really need. So it's here where I usually embrace rituals of some sort or a devotional practice. It might be a threefold puja at home, often with kids banging drums and blowing whistles, or it might be burning something in the fire or just making a mandala out of sand and leaves when I'm on the beach. I guess because I have young children, I have to take what I can get, but those short times allow some sort of space, allow a gap that nourishes me in a way that is beyond my own understanding, so that I can turn just a little bit more towards my experience and really truly see what it is that's happening and what I really need. So it's just a note, I used to hate things like that on retreat, that sense of doing rituals and chanting, because I didn't understand it, because I wanted to intellectually understand it. And so it wasn't until I made them my own and I started doing them at home and creating them for myself and into my own life that they really started to make sense. So if they're new to you or if you don't connect with them, just bring a little bit of patience, because it's worth it, because they're not something that can be understood by the rational mind. So the next realm is the hell realm or the Naraka realm, and it's the world of the tormented beings. And this is where there's unchecked anger and aggression, there's unhappiness, there's miserable faces, and it's akin to the experience of a mental breakdown. It's where people are suffering unspeakable torments. And this might be an actual event, or it might be the state of mind that surrounds the events. For me, when I look into the mirror nowadays, it's more likely to be a self-induced state of mind. But it's a state where there's no peace, where it's full of tightness and anger and fear and shame. So what's really interesting about this realm is that the smoked-coloured Buddha in this realm provides a balm to ease suffering. And it can be interpreted as a balm that kind of soothes the physical pain of these unbearable torments, but also more of a transcendental balm or nectar that allows this deathless or eternal state, a state that we also know as nirvana. So there is an affinity between this intense mental suffering and the susceptibility to spiritual attainment. So I know this realm intensely through some of the life events of bereavement and depression. But mostly nowadays, I only fall into this world when I'm actually pushing away the emotions and the experience that's happening in the moment. So I'm pushing away the pain, and then that causes me more suffering. So this psychological state can happen when there are big life changes, when there are traumas or bereavements. But because also we live in a conditioned world and we have conditioned minds, we can also fall into this psychological state when we move house, when we turn a year older, or perhaps when we just put on a couple of extra kilograms. And again, I think in this state we really need kindness and wisdom. And usually that's when I listen to Dharma talks, because there's something just too painful to be able to just stay with the present moment experience at that time. So I also use the mantras that I mentioned before, and that allows a sense of doing something and being soothed. But it's doing something more skillful, because actually what we want to do is to switch from the old habits and move into a more creative way of being. And there's a sense that by doing something more skillful than before, I open up to the possibility of catching a Dharma seed that might bring me some relief, either at that moment or at another time. So the next realm is the realm of the animals. And this is a realm of just purely sensual indulgence of our basic needs, like food and sleep and sex. And it appears in the wheel as a peaceful realm, but it's filled with stupidity and complacency. Because animals don't worry about being eaten tomorrow. They just live in the moment. And it is all peaceful in this realm until an animal doesn't get its needs met. And then, as we all know, then animals can actually turn quite nasty. So when I look in the mirror, I connect this with when I'm really in a self-absorbed state. It's a very narrow state, just only attending to what I need and just taking no notice of others. It's like when I'm really tired and I don't really care about what other people are talking about or what other people want to do. I just want to go home and go to sleep. So there's a blue Buddha in this realm holding a book and encouraging a move to be more civilized and more cultured. So when I act really selfishly and I think only of my own needs, so when I'm really tired, I don't want to pick up a Dharma book. I don't want to meditate. I just want to switch off and slob out and attend to my needs and just be unmindful to the experience that I'm having. So this book really symbolizes cultivating that gap or that space to, you know, access that creative mind that we have, to be a little bit more spontaneous and not fall into the old habits. So some of those old habits might be that we open a bottle of wine or we check Facebook. And really what we need to be doing is to be choosing something more kinder and more in tune with ourselves than for what we really need. So what helps me in this state is just looking at beautiful images. So standing at my shrine or remaking my shrine, bringing nature, bringing images of the Buddha to it, finding pictures and colours of the five Buddhas that just connect with me at that moment, or watching the ocean. Also using mudras. So in Buddhism there are lots of hand movements that are quite important and have a strong connection, a strong kind of body-mind connection. So there is something about just placing my hands open on my lap or doing the earth-touching mudra that really allows me to connect with something beyond myself that is more wise and more skillful. So moving from the animal realm finally into the human realm. So this is depicted by humans experiencing a real mixture of emotions. They're neither ecstatic or agonized. In this realm or state, we're just aware of our own self and of other people. And although we can attend to our basic needs, but we realize that they're limited and therefore we have a potential to devote ourselves to spiritual development. So it's a truly human state and one I actually rarely dwell in, except when I'm here at the center or with Sangha. So when I'm at the center or with spiritual friends, the Sangha, things often feel easier. It doesn't mean that my life is easier, life's still hard, but there is more space to breathe and there's more clarity. So in this realm there is a saffron-coloured Buddha holding a begging bowl and a three-ring staff. And this is the potential for all human beings to be able to follow the Dharma and to become enlightened. So as we turn to face the mirror again, we can see where we might be right now or where we spend most of our time. And for me, in truth, I think it's in the realm of the Titans because I'm so conditioned to be averse to the minimal amount of discomfort. And it ends up that because of that aversion, I become particularly irritable towards the people that I love. But perhaps for you, it's the human state or the God realm or the hell realm. But however much we do work on the wheel and how on whatever realm we want to be in or what we want to get out of, we're still on the wheel. we're still living this conditioned experience. But there is potential to escape from this will, from the mundane and the conditioned world. It's on the spiral path, which Amaradipa is going to talk about next week. So I've used and talked a little bit about some of the symbols that I use. And I think if we truly accept ourselves and what our mind states are and where we often dwell, then we can turn towards it. And if the wheel is a symbol and it's helped with the unconscious realization of determining what we are, then perhaps it can also help with how we can be with ourselves in these realms. So whether it's a snake, a pig, a hungry ghost, or a tormented being, three types of symbols, the images, the mantra, and the rituals, they all have an uncanny way of affecting us beyond our consciousness, beyond the reasoned intellect. So this is when maybe we reassess this woman who thinks she's a green snake and who may be a little bit loopy. Because what do you really have to lose? So if you're suffering in the hell realm, or you're sitting with hungry ghosts, could things be any worse? And if you're about to fall out of the heavens from the God realm, why not try something different? Isn't it worth a shot? Isn't this why we're all here? So we might not understand the wheel or even connect with it. We might just see ourselves in certain realms and not in others. The use of it is really to see ourselves, which is forever changing, and just let go into this symbolic experience and explore where it might take us. So when you're lost and you're not sure where you might be or what you might be looking at in the mirror, where there are painful emotions such as fear or shame or grief, look to the different ways of being with symbols, to the images, to the mantras and rituals, and just explore them and start the spiritual journey. Thank you.